Today is Monday, January 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Opo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, North Korea tests its most powerful missile since President Joe Biden took office, significantly escalating tensions with the United States.
It's the longest-range missile North Korea has tested since 2017, during the height of its tensions with the United States. Many analysts say Sunday's test may have involved the Hwasong-12, with a range of 4,500 kilometers.
NATO says it has no plans to deploy combat troops to Ukraine in the event of a Russian invasion.
But again, Ukraine is not a NATO ally, so the 100% security guarantees that an attack on one ally will trigger a response from the whole alliance, that applies for NATO allies, not close and highly valued partners.
And low food supplies threaten UN humanitarian operations in Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. North Korea on Sunday fired what appeared to be the most powerful missile it has tested since President Joe Biden took office, significantly escalating tensions with the United States. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
It's the longest-range missile North Korea has tested since 2017, during the height of its tensions with the United States. Many analysts say Sunday's test may have involved the Hwasong-12.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in said that North Korea has taken a step closer to fully scrapping a self-imposed moratorium on testing its longest-range interballistic missiles after a suspected missile test was reported on Sunday. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff reported that a projectile believed to be a single ballistic missile was launched about 7:52 a.m. from North Korea's Jagang province towards the ocean off its east coast. South Korea's National Security Council said the test appeared to involve an intermediate-range ballistic missile, which North Korea has not tested since 2017. Moon also called on North Korea to stop creating tensions and to return to talks. NATO has no plans to deploy combat troops to non-NATO member Ukraine in the event of a Russian invasion, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said on Sunday. Asked on BBC television whether he would rule out putting NATO troops in Ukraine if Russia does not invade, he said, quote, "We have no plans to deploy NATO combat troops to Ukraine," unquote. Stoltenberg also emphasized the limits of NATO's partnership with Ukraine, stating that the security guarantees that an attack on one ally would trigger a response from the whole alliance does not apply to Ukraine since it is not a NATO ally. Britain's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss also told the BBC Sunday morning show that it is very unlikely British troops will be sent to fight alongside Ukrainian troops in the event of a Russian invasion. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
We have no plans to deploy NATO combat troops to Ukraine. NATO allies have trainers there. We help them from NATO with building capacity, modernizing their defenses, including their cyber defenses. NATO allies also provide equipment, defensive weapons, like the UK has now provided, for instance, anti-tank weapons. So we do a lot of stuff to help Ukraine strengthen its ability, capability to defend itself. But again, Ukraine is not a NATO ally, so the 100% security guarantees that an attack on one ally will trigger a response from the whole alliance, that applies for NATO allies, not close and highly valued partners. We are concerned about the energy situation in Europe because it demonstrates the vulnerability of being too dependent on one supplier of natural gas. And that's the reason why NATO allies agree that we need to work and focus on diversification of supplies. And we also took very carefully note of what the International Energy Agency said recently, that Russia has manipulated the European gas market by holding back supplies.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Russia will ask NATO to clarify whether it intends to implement key security commitments, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Sunday, after Moscow said the alliance's response to its demands did not go far enough. Russia has forced the U.S.-led Defense Alliance and the 57-member Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to negotiate over regional security by massing over 100,000 troops near Ukraine while denying it plans to invade. Russian President Putin said on Friday the United States and NATO had not addressed Moscow's main security demands in their stand-up over Ukraine, but that it was ready to keep talking. A Russian lawmaker has encouraged residents in rebel-held territories in Ukraine to join the Russian army. AP correspondent Karin Chamas reports.
The move by Viktor Vodolatsky is a sign that Russia is continuing to try to integrate rebel-controlled areas as much as possible. Vodolatsky's announcement comes as the West worries that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine. The offer is to residents with Russian passports living in the regions controlled by Russian-backed rebels since 2014. Many living in the area fear assaults by Ukrainian forces. Russia has granted passports to more than 500,000 people in the territories. Vodolatsky said the recruits would serve in Russia, but that leaves open the option that they could join any future invasion force. I'm Karen Chamas.
In an interview, the U.S. ambassador to Russia, John J. Sullivan, said a Russian incursion into Ukraine will trigger sanctions, including potentially shutting down its Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline to Germany.
Should Russia further invade Ukraine, I would expect that that would be Nord Stream 2 would be part of a significant, there have been several adjectives used, massive economic consequences that would flow to Russia in the event that they take that action.
That's U.S. Ambassador to Russia, John J. Sullivan. Some supporters of Burkina Faso's military coup this week were seen celebrating with Russian flags and calling for their country to switch alliance from France to Moscow. While the extent of pro-Russian sentiment in Burkina Faso is unclear, there is no doubt many are fed up with French efforts to help fight gangs and Islamic militant groups. Harry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Riding through the streets of Ouagadougou, two demonstrators fly a Russian flag, celebrating a military coup in the country a day earlier. They also turned out in Ouagadougou's Place de la Nation to celebrate the military takeover. Some waved a Russian flag and told VOA,
"We don't want no more France. We are here because we need the defense of Russia. France haven't done anything. Who has given us success?"
France has been giving military assistance to Burkina Faso during its six-year conflict with armed groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Earlier this month, the leader of neighbouring Mali, Colonel Assimi Goïta, welcomed mercenaries into the country from the Russian private security company Wagner, which has close links to the Kremlin. The mercenaries took over a military base in Timbuktu that was vacated by French troops in December. Demonstrators in Burkina Faso carried pictures of Goïta at this week's demonstration and on January 22nd held a march in solidarity with Mali. Police broke up the gathering using flashbangs and tear gas. Analysts say in recent months there has been growing anti-French sentiment and a pivot towards Russia. Analysts say Mali is using Russian involvement as a bargaining chip after the West African bloc ECOWAS sanctioned the country for refusing to hold democratic elections within the next 5 years. Paul Melly is an analyst with Chatham House, a London-based think tank.
The Malian military junta is trying to mobilise national feeling, if you like. It seems to have brought the Russians in, or sought to bring the Russians in, as a sort of tool of leverage. It's not entirely clear how much practical military impact could actually bring.
The Russian embassy for Burkina Faso and the military junta both declined to give VOA an interview. Bernard Bermuga, a Burkinabe political commentator, is pragmatic about the situation. Whether Burkina Faso aligns with France, Russia, or another country, Bermogo said, it's not out of generosity, it's not free. They'll want something in return. What is needed is someone who can help Burkina Faso get out of the situation in which it finds itself. Activist Francois Biogo attended the demonstration. Biogo said the French must let them work things out on their own. The demonstrators are not against France, but France must manage their affairs and allow Burkinabes to manage theirs. Without France, soldiers will have peace of mind and be able to reflect on how to organise and free the people. Meanwhile, the Russian organisation that trains troops in the Central African Republic has offered military support to Burkina Faso. It remains to be seen if Burkina Faso's new de facto leader, Paul-Henri Damiba, will take up the offer. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, warns it may be forced to end its humanitarian operation in northern Ethiopia's embattled Tigray province because supplies are running out. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Intense fighting in northern Ethiopia has prevented aid from getting through to millions of destitute people in Tigray since mid-December. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says UN and private aid agencies already have been forced to scale back operations because of severe shortages of supplies, fuel, and cash.
Organizations have warned that operations could cease completely by the end of February. Nutrition supplies for supplementary feeding and treatment of severe acute malnutrition have already run out.
The World Food Program says 13% of Tigrayan children under the age of five and half of all pregnant and breastfeeding women are malnourished, a condition that increases the risk of infection and death. Laerke says international aid agencies operating in Tigray report their last fuel stocks were depleted on January 24th. Since then, he says, aid workers have been delivering the little remaining humanitarian supplies and services on foot where possible.
We have seen in recent days, of course, the UN Humanitarian Air Service has picked up again and they are delivering. But you cannot deliver by plane at all the kind of volumes of aid that is clearly needed in the situation.
War between Ethiopian government forces and the Tigray People's Liberation Fund broke out in November 2020. Since then, the conflict has spread to the neighboring Amhara and Afar regions, displacing hundreds of thousands and pushing up rates of hunger and malnutrition. Unlike the situation in Tigray, Laerke says aid agencies can scale up assistance in accessible parts of Amhara and Afar. He says food has been distributed to more than 500,000 people in Amhara during the past week, and nearly 380,000 people in Afar have been reached in an ongoing round of food distribution. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A collapsed bridge in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, just hours ahead of President Joe Biden's visit to the city, underscored the need to improve the nation's crumbling infrastructure. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara has this report.
Immediately upon landing in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, President Joe Biden visited the Fern Hollow Bridge that collapsed Friday morning, injuring at least 10 people.
They're going to fix them all. Not a joke. This is going to be a gigantic change.
The bridge collapsed just hours ahead of Biden's planned visit to the city's Carnegie Mellon University Research Center to underscore the need to improve the nation's crumbling infrastructure, address supply chain shortages, and revitalize manufacturing.
The United States of America used to be ranked number one in the world in investing in the future. Now we rank number nine in research and development. China was number eight 3 decades ago. Today, it's number two.
Biden's $1.2 trillion infrastructure law passed in November with bipartisan support. $550 billion is allocated to federal infrastructure investments, which analysts say is much needed. Andy Winkler is Bipartisan Policy Center's Director for Housing and Infrastructure Projects.
We have had some really tragic infrastructure failures across the country, whether it's bridges like what happened today or water systems. And I think it shows the global community that how far we've fallen behind.
Just 41% of Americans approve of the job Biden is doing, according to the latest Pew Research poll, due to the ongoing pandemic and rising inflation. Consumer prices have increased, driven by the global supply chain crisis caused by unpredictable demand and pandemic worker shortages. The administration has provided $230 million to improve port infrastructure and incentives to recruit more truck drivers. Panos Koveles is a professor of supply chain at Washington University in St. Louis.
Hopefully, we'll increase the efficiency of the ports and better roads and better trains and so on. But those things are not going to help us the next 6 months.
In Pittsburgh, Biden also pushed for his Build Back Better bill on child care, other social spending, and climate change, which is currently stalled in the Senate. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Electric vehicles are in high demand as gas prices and concerns about carbon emission and global warming climb. From the 2022 Washington Auto Show, VOA's Sadiq Al-Islam examines where consumers and car manufacturers think all electric vehicles are heading in the future.
Exotic and luxury cars show off their futuristic features, but the main attraction at the 2022 Washington Auto Show is the EV Pavilion, where the new battery-powered vehicles have been stealing the show. Electric vehicle sales increased by 41% globally in 2020. Major automobile manufacturers like Toyota and Ford are now working to produce more electric models, which are not only fuel efficient, but also climate friendly. Looking to upgrade his car, Mark Spencer drove 3 hours with his son and father to check out the electric vehicles. He's looking for one with better mileage and price, but he has other concerns too.
They need to get the price down so everyone can afford it, and they said they really need the infrastructure to support them. You just can't afford to wait at a gas station for 30 minutes for a charge.
The Washington Auto Show is back after a year's gap, and this year's highlights are electric vehicles and their infrastructure. The EV Pavilion at the Auto Show is sponsored by Electrify America, a Washington-based fast charging station network that extends across the United States. With the theme, "The Future is Electric," Electrify America's aim is to make it easy for consumers to adopt electric vehicles. O'Donnell says American consumers are now more open-minded about adopting electric vehicles since the government is providing tax credits and more incentives are coming in President Biden's Build Back Better plan. Saqib al-Islam, VOA News, Washington.
A Swedish-Kenyan company, Opibus, has introduced the first African-designed and manufactured electric bus in Kenya with the aim of bringing clean energy to public transportation. Opibus, Kenya's first company to make electric motorcycles, plans to launch the bus commercially in a few months and bring it to market across Africa by 2023. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
As other vehicles jostle for space while belching clouds of dark smoke in the streets of Nairobi, Benjamin Miner is driving a unique bus, one that is fully electric.
I feel privileged driving this vehicle. It's also very amazing when you are driving this vehicle compared to the fossil fuels vehicles, considering there is a lot of vibrations on fossil fuel vehicles and also a lot of noise. But with this vehicle, it's quite silent and very sleek.
Public transport in Kenya and across the African continent is largely run informally, and emission standards are rarely enforced, making the vehicles highly pollutive, as Jane Akumu, a sustainable mobility expert at the UN Environment Programme, explains.
If you look at the cities, the heavy-duty vehicles, which are buses and trucks, that's the bulk of the pollution, you know. So they are a big contributor to pollution. But as I said, they're also an opportunity, because how do we shift to cleaner modes? How do we shift? Because we need mass transport to be sustainable, to make cities more sustainable.
The introduction of electric buses into the African market by Opibus is aimed at remedying the situation. Albin Wilson is the chief of strategy and marketing at Opibus.
This electric bus is a really important first step in the transition from fossil fuel vehicles to electric clean mobility, right? And I think we really show precedence being the first movers in this market with a bus that's even locally developed.
Christopher Miner is a resident of Nairobi. VOA asked him about his experience as a passenger riding on an electric bus.
The ride today is one of its own, having ridden on an electric vehicle. It's just cool, no noises like the combustion engines. There are no smells like the combustion engine. So it's just cool and awesome to be in these vehicles.
Africa's electric car market, currently in its infancy, presents a huge opportunity for investment and the creation of green jobs, says experts. Here again is Jane Akumu.
When you look at our source of electricity, it is renewable. You know, for example, in Ethiopia, it's almost 100% renewable energy, hydro and such. If you look at Kenya, it's over 90-something percent. So we have the energy, you know, we don't have to import fossil fuels, petrol, diesel and all that. So we have the energy here. Then this is also a very good opportunity for jobs, green jobs.
Benjamin Maina notes one other benefit of his electric bus: lower cost of maintenance and fuel. It means more money in his pocket, he says, and a higher standard of living. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
In other news, thousands of Sudanese have taken to the streets for the latest in a month-long string of protests to denounce an October military coup that plunged the country into turmoil. Thousands of protesters, mostly young men and women, marched in the streets of the capital, Khartoum, and other cities Sunday. They called for a fully civilian government to lead the country's now-stalled transition to democracy. The military takeover has scuttled hopes of a peaceful transition to democracy in Sudan, more than 2 years after a popular uprising forced the removal of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. The turmoil in the country has been amplified since the prime minister stepped down earlier this month. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The United Nations called for the investigation by the Saudi-led coalition into recent strikes on a Houthi-run detention facility in Yemen to be independent and transparent. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Three airstrikes in quick succession hit a Houthi-run detention facility in the northern Yemen city of Sada January 21st, one of the deadliest single attacks in Yemen's nearly 7-year civil war. Initial findings by aid agencies indicate 91 detainees were killed and 236 injured. United Nations human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says colleagues who were in Sada this week as part of an interagency mission are working to verify the number of civilian casualties.
The information they have collected paints a chaotic and desperate picture after the Rahman prison, which was believed to be holding some 1,300 pretrial detainees as well as 700 migrants, was struck by these airstrikes.
The most severely injured have been taken to a hospital in Sada. Colville says the medical staff is struggling to deal with the number of patients needing urgent treatment. The Saudi-led coalition says it has begun an investigation into the attacks. Colville says such a probe must be conducted in a transparent, independent, and impartial manner in line with international standards. To be credible, he says the investigation must establish why the prison was hit. It must ensure individual accountability for any breaches of international humanitarian law and must identify steps to prevent such incidents in the future.
During the recent visit by our team this week, we saw no signs indicating that this site, which was formerly a barracks, continues to have a military function. And in light of this, we have asked the coalition to share their information with us.
The United Nations recorded just under 600 airstrikes a month across Yemen by the government-backed Saudi-led coalition last year. Also in 2021, it reported the Iran-backed Houthi rebels had launched 340 missile and drone attacks on Saudi territory. The escalating conflict has taken a devastating toll on Yemen's civilian population. The United Nations reports more than 377,000 people have died, 60% by indirect causes such as disease and hunger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There has been a mixed response to Australia's $700 million plan to combat water pollution on the Great Barrier Reef, the world's largest reef system. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The 9-year Australian plan promises to fund projects that reduce erosion and pesticides and fertilizers running off farmland into the sea. There'll be other conservation efforts, including combating coral-eating crown-of-thorn starfish and illegal fishing. The Australian Marine Conservation Society has welcomed the initiative. It said that curbing pollution was essential to build the reef's resilience to climate change. Environment Minister Susan Ley says the plan will help protect one of the country's great natural treasures.
This is an extraordinary investment in a reef. I don't think there's ever been one as large anywhere in the world. The reef economy is worth $6.4 billion. There are 64,000 jobs that depend on the reef. And if you live anywhere along one of our reef communities in Queensland, you know how important it is. So it's also about COVID recovery, because our tourism operators are waiting to show national and international tourists our beautiful Great Barrier Reef.
However, other scientists have said that action to improve water quality will mean nothing if global carbon emissions aren't reduced. They've identified climate change as the major threat to the 344,400 square kilometre ecosystem that stretches down Australia's northeast coast. Warming ocean temperatures have caused widespread coral bleaching in recent years. Under stress, the corals expel symbiotic algae, which live in their tissues and give the corals their colour and supply them with nutrients. The reef narrowly avoided being listed as in danger by UNESCO last year amid concerns over its long-term health. In October, a study by the Global Coral Reef Monitoring Network, a United Nations-supported network of researchers, reported that about 14% of the world's coral had been lost since 2009. It found that reefs were among the world's most vulnerable ecosystems to man-made threats, including climate change, overfishing and pollution. Australia's Great Barrier Reef spans an area about the size of Japan. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Every year during the Sundance Film Festival, the New Frontier exhibition introduces technologies in storytelling. This is the second year the festival and exhibit have gone digital due to COVID-19. VOA's Penelope Pelu spoke with curator Sherry Freelot on New Frontier's visual platforms for art, film, and performance.
Welcome to the spaceship. This virtual venue, overlooking planet Earth and the International Space Station, allows festival-goers digital avatars to attend performances, watch movies, participate in presentations, and mingle, all that remotely through a computer or a virtual reality headset. Sherry Frillo, curator of the New Frontier exhibition, says the mission this year was to bring the Sundance community together in the metaverse, a computer-generated environment where users can interact.
You go to the Space Garden, which is where you find the portal to the cinema house. You are inside of an art house theater, fashioned like the Egyptian.
The Egyptian is the festival's iconic movie theater on Park City, Utah's Main Street. Its digital equivalent can hold 100 digital avatars.
And you're sitting and you're with people and you can talk, and the presentation will start. Mostly we're in there with artists. Maybe it's the day that cosmogony is happening.
Once a performance or a film ends, visitors can head to the gallery where they can view exhibits. Some can be experienced best with virtual reality headsets. One of these projects is called Gondwana.
It is a 24-hour simulation of the rainforest game tree in Australia. And it's powered by dynamic climate change data. And the longer you're in there, every 12 minutes is like a year, you start to see the rainforest change. And depending on how many people are in there, will determine how it changes. And you can go in and out of it throughout the day, the 24-hour cycle, and see it and witness it where it started and where it might end.
At the spaceship's film party, visitors and artists meet, exchange ideas, and talk about films and projects. This digital platform allows people to not only watch, but also interact, Frillo says, an activity made less frequent due to the pandemic and video streaming.
It is important to have, you know, our technology support what is human and how we relate to one another and how we can transcend physical boundaries to have access to what makes us people and what makes us thrive in a, you know, that collective spirit.
Frillo says nothing can replace shared experiencing of art in a physical space. She says these new technologies can serve culture by making storytelling accessible and connecting people around the world. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afoyinwu.